All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. Yeah. All right. Now, I'm going to get this all straight. The schedule is just like swirling around in my head right now. At the back end of the show, we are going to be joined by two of the actors and the director of a play called Dr. Anonymous. This is a really, really powerful play. It's all about gay conversion therapy and the battle that gay people have waged and all people should be waging for the recognizing and fighting to defend the humanity of gay people, of all people. And in particular, this is the, sort of a theme of today's show, the future of humanity in a certain way. Before that, we will be listening to an interview I did with Dr. Michael Mann from Penn State University, and he's a very, very big man in the climate warming, global warming circle of things. We're going to be talking with him about the new IPCC report, which should have everyone sort of like angry and really, really concerned. But opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show a regular guest and somebody who never leaves without intriguing many people and pushing people in their minds and sort of jabbing them and saying, look, you got to look at what's going on in the world. And in particular, what's going on with the all-out assault on women. And Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org. And she's joining us today to talk about the abortion rights emergency and some plans for National Days of Emergency Actions and what's behind all this. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks so much for having me and working with me on the schedule here.
You didn't have to say that. Just remember, Leslie Gore was waiting in the wings, okay?
Okay.
And she's very angry. She's sitting out there drinking a cup of coffee. She said, I would have never come if I knew. Anyway, let's jump into this because we have just a little time. You are actually involved in pulling together a weekend of national actions and in response to, in a certain way, and standing up against a war on women that is spearheaded in many ways by an all-out assault on abortion rights. Now, this is not something that sort of is, I mean, people should know it, but when you put it together for most people, it's sort of like, wow, really? That's, So why don't you tell people, what exactly is the situation? What's making this weekend necessary?
Well, in this country, there is a total emergency facing women's right to abortion. I know that some people have heard the words war on women thrown around. Some people have said, oh, that's an exaggeration. It's very, very true. It's very, very true. Right now, already in this country, there are regions where women have zero access to abortion and where they are risking their lives to self-induce abortions. They're using sharp objects and inserting them into their vaginas. They're using drinking or taking pills that they don't know what they'll do to their bodies and their health. We've heard stories of women, in multiple places, not isolated stories of women asking their boyfriends to beat them up to try to get them to miscarriage. And we have a situation where already many, many women are being forced to have children that they do not want and cannot care for. And this is foreclosing their lives. This is closing their lives down. And I think this is already an emergency. I don't want to talk just about what will happen in the future. It's happening now, in rural and poor areas and inner cities and small towns. And it is the future for women everywhere if this is not massively resisted. The last 3 years have seen 203 laws. And that's a huge number, so it can be kind of numbing for people to hear it. Oh, there's always a new law. It seems like there's always a new law being introduced. But actually think about what it means. 203 laws restricting one of the most basic and essential rights of women to determine for themselves when and whether they will bear children. What could be more central to a woman's role and position in society than her ability to determine that? And this is being restricted and taken out of the reach of people. And then there's terror. There's violence that goes on. There was a clinic that was, I'm sure your listeners, most of them don't even know this because it's not been covered. There was a clinic in Montana that was so viciously vandalized and attacked that it has been forced to close. It cannot function. This is like the equivalent of a black church being bombed in the civil rights era, or even today, and having no media cover it. The New York Times didn't cover it. NPR hasn't done a story. Nobody even knows about this, and this gives a green light for more of this terror. And this also underscores why it is an emergency, and it is on the people, it is on us to stand up and sound the alarm and act to resist this and turn this around.
You know, one of the things, too, I was looking at as I was preparing for this and just, thinking about what is the state of affairs right now. I don't know how many people actually followed this, but you know that law that was in Texas that was basically designed to shut down many, many, many of the abortion clinics. And you raised some astounding figure of the number of clinics that will actually exist by next year if this continues. But that law was actually upheld by the federal court now. You know, the law that was actually going to result in the closure of all these clinics in Texas. And that was kind of, you know, it just sort of, bam, there it was. There it happened. And then I read something else in Revolution newspaper on, or maybe it was on the Stop Patriarchy site, stoppatriarchy.org, where it talked about the combination of the assault on abortion like you're talking about, but also then there's this thing about also the assault on women's right and ability to even practice contraception.
That's right. And I think it is important. People should understand, first of all, it's very essential that women have the right to abortion. Women have always needed this right, and they will always seek to exercise this right, whether or not it's legal. The only question is whether it will be safe or whether they will die in the process. And so I don't want to in any way back away from the centrality or the fight for abortion, but it's important to understand that the people who are out to end abortion, they are not doing this. They're not concerned about babies. That's not what this is about. This is about controlling women and forcing them to have children against their will, and they are against birth control. There's something like over 90 legal challenges in the courts right now to the federal mandate in the health care bill to require birth control coverage. These are forces, Christian fascist and fundamentalist forces mainly, as well as anti-woman patriarchal forces who are outraged by the notion that women will control their own fertility. And I think it should be a wake-up call to everybody. If we allow this to go down, the assault on abortion, the closure of clinics, the terror against the doctor, and the aging out of doctors who really are graying and retiring because they came out of a generation that fought for women's liberation, and the new generation has been disoriented and demobilized and largely is not getting this training. So if this is allowed to happen, it won't stop. As horrific as it is, it will not stop with abortion. They are coming for women's birth control. And, you know, everything about the way that what people take for granted today, women in the professions, women in the media, women in sports, all of this would not happen if women didn't have the right to birth control and to abortion. It's that central. It's not the only thing that's required to fight and liberate women, which is a very urgent need and is part of why we need a revolution, ultimately, to win full liberation. The right to abortion and birth control is not the only dimension of that, but the liberation of women and the equality of women is impossible without these rights, and that is exactly why they're being gone after.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution newspaper and a founder of StopPatriarchy.org. You know, you mentioned before that the point about the need to actually stand up and fight this, and that's a big theme in what you're talking about today and what you're doing overall. And one of the things is that you've also spoken and written about in places where, with the situation today, there's a real danger of there being a new normalcy in the society, that certain these things that you're talking about, for instance, the all-out assault on abortion and the painting of abortion as something like really criminal and that should be just buried and never, never spoken of again, and women being consigned to what amounts to fundamentally slavery, there's a normalcy that sort of, if it's not opposed, it actually is a creeping, you know, standard in the country right now.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. It is becoming normalized that people, like, that's why I bring up this abortion clinic in Montana that was destroyed. I mean, the level of hatred, the level of viciousness, the level of danger directed at the courageous woman who's been providing abortions there for over 40 years is, it ought to be a wake-up call to the country, and instead there was deafening silence. There was just deafening silence across the board, and that is saying that this is going to be treated like normal. We're not going to react to this. We're going to let this go on. It's a green light, and we cannot allow that. I do want to say, though, as bad, and I'm emphasizing how dangerous and how extreme this situation is and how stark the emergency is, I don't think it would be possible to overstate that right now. But I do want to emphasize, too, about this question of a new normalcy is that this is not settled yet, and there is a moment when things like this are in rapid transformation, there is a moment when people have not yet swallowed this. They've not yet accepted this. This has not yet become the normalcy. There's a danger of it. But this is a moment when people, if we stand up and fight, actually, we could reverse this direction. It's not going to be easy. It will take struggle. It will take sacrifice. People are afraid that we're going to have to overcome our fear. We're going to have to break down the isolation, and we're going to have to go into the streets in public protest and resistance. We're going to have to raise our voices and fill the streets. But if we do that before this has become accepted as the new normalcy, if we do that now, there is a tremendous reservoir of people. There are millions and millions of people. And Stop Patriarchy, we've seen this all over the country. We saw it last year in the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We saw it when people flooded down to the state capitol in Texas to try to stop that abortion law. We've seen the potential that exists, but that has to be called forward and mobilized. And that's why Stop Patriarchy is working with others to organize 2 days of emergency actions. On April 11th, it will be a national day of speakouts and a national webcast with people sounding the alarm, exposing the truth that's been kept from them. We're going to have the doctor from the last abortion clinic in Mississippi, Dr. Willie Parker, a courageous and wonderful man. Reverend Donna Schopper from Judson Memorial Church, a courageous and wonderful religious leader who's going to speak openly about her own abortion. Merle Hoffman, who has provided abortions in New York City for 43 years at her medical clinic Choices. And myself, other speakers. It's going to be an outpouring that people can tune into and hold house parties all across this country, bring some friends together and learn what's going on. And then the following day, April 12th, we are going into the streets in New York, in L.A., in Chicago, but in places, you know, there is time for people to organize themselves wherever you are to join with us and be part of a national mobilization that's starting to change the tide on this and call forth resistance. We're going to raise bloody coat hangers representing how women actually died from using coat hangers to induce abortions before it was legal, and shackles representing the enslavement of women. And we're going to go to the institutions that are behind this war on women, the GOP headquarters, the crisis pregnancy centers, the Democratic headquarters, where they're responsible for this too, which they are. And we're going to do these silent protests, and at the end of an hour of silence, we're going to break the chains, and we are going to recite a pledge to resist that is both our own commitment being forged, but also calling forward and modeling the kind of strength and courage and determination and fearlessness and refusal to be silent that we need to continue to model, but that other people need to step forward and find within themselves as well. And as bad as it is, it will get worse, but it's not inevitable. We don't have to lie down and accept this. And that's the main message that I want to share with people, that StopPatriarchy.org wants to share with people, that people are coming together nationwide, providers, religious leaders, women telling their stories of illegal abortions, coming together to make clear is that it's on us and it's possible to resist this and to stop this. And that's what we have to do.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. You know, Sansara, one of the things I wanted to, I think it's really important what you're hitting at now. And one of the things I have to say is when I was reading the recent article you had in Revolution Newspaper, it was very, very heavy that you talked about some of the stuff of both the need to carry this out, but to stand up and fight and to change the sort of the polarization in society around us. And you did it in a way that was really, I thought, very powerful, because it not only talked about what needs to be done, but also pointed out that, look, part of this thing of the battle against the new normalcy kind of thing and preventing that from happening is exactly one thing that you mentioned, and I know we have just a little bit of time to get into this, but I think it's worth talking about. For a lot of people, they think, okay, somehow we can find somebody, whether it's Wendy Davis, Barack Obama, or Hillary Clinton, or the Democrats in general, and work with them, and not really looking at this as, not only is it sort of, yeah, pipe dream, but it's also, it does great harm, and I think it's really important to sort of compare and contrast for a minute.
I'm really glad you asked that, and I'll try to be brief. For decades now, people who support abortion rights, pro-choice people, and frankly, the mainstream pro-choice organizations have seen as their only way of fighting, relying on the Democrats, lobbying the Democrats, relying on the courts, trying to turn out people to vote for the sort of lesser of the evils. But the entire dynamic of the terms around abortion keep moving further and further to the right. I'll give one brief example because I think it highlights this. Is in Virginia, there was a law about a year and a half ago that the Republicans introduced that would have mandated a vaginal ultrasound before a woman could get an abortion. Totally unnecessary medically, but the state would mandate the penetration of a woman's vagina with a medical instrument before she could get an abortion. It's basically a state-mandated rape. The Democrats and a lot of the pro-choice groups said, oh, that's really outrageous. Don't make her get a vaginal ultrasound. Don't do that. That's really wrong. And it is really wrong. But they that's the extent of it. They didn't say women need the right to abortion. Stop restricting abortion. Stop this war on women. Let's fight for abortion on demand without apology. And instead, the Republicans took the vaginal ultrasound out of the bill, and they mandated an ultrasound from the abdomen. And that bill went through. And the Democrats called it a victory. What you ended up with was a restriction being called a victory. And this has demobilized and disoriented many, many people who've been supporting and thinking that the Democrats are fighting for them. They're not fighting for this right. They're going along with this right being taken away, putting up petty objections and letting it happen. And the other thing they're doing that is doing great harm is they are accepting the moral and political terms of the anti-abortion movement. Hillary says abortion should be rare, safe, legal, and rare. Why should it be rare? It should be as available as necessary to women. There's nothing wrong with it. They accept, Wendy Davis does too, and Obama does as well. Wendy Davis said she would accept a ban on abortion at 20 weeks in pregnancy. She would have accepted that law and not done her filibuster if it had only been that restriction. That's not a defense of women's right to abortion. That's not a fight to reverse this war on women. And that is demobilizing in people's activities, their resources, their money, and in their thinking and morality. It puts them on the defensive, and it has been deadly. And we have to get out of that by relying on ourselves, telling the truth. Forced motherhood is female enslavement. Women need abortion on demand and without apology, and going into the streets and fighting for that and calling forward millions of others, because that's what it's going to take. And that is possible, but it's on us. So I want to end by urging people, everybody can do something. Go to stoppatriarchy.org today. Go to revcom.us today. Get connected with the movement that is really fighting to turn this around. Bring your perspective, bring your questions, bring your energy, bring your resources, but join with others who are refusing to let this go down.
All right. Once again, Sansara, you were really wonderful, really very powerful, and thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you, Michael.
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the founders of StopPatriarchy.org. Now, if perchance you're listening to the show at a time after the weekend events have happened, after these hitting the streets around abortion rights and stopping the war on women has happened, take the opportunity to go and check out StopPatriarchy.org. You can watch the video of the Speak Out in New York City, the Speak Out that featured all kinds of people talking about their experiences having an abortion and why it's important that all women have access to safe abortions when they need them. That's right, abortion on demand and without apology. And one more thing, if you really want to dig into what it's going to take to get rid of the oppression of women, go to revcom.us and check out the special issue of Revolution Newspaper titled A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity. Once again, that's revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Professor Michael Mann from Penn State University about the latest report from the United Nations on global warming. So stay tuned. All right, welcome back. And that's Marvin Gaye with Mercy, Mercy Me, Ecology. All right, that's a great song. And March 29th, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued a report, Climate Change 2014 Impacts Adaptation and Vulnerability. This, basically the message of this report is the whole damn planet is burning. All right, and we can't just sit here and watch. All right. People really got to think about what's going on. The rise in global temperatures due to fossil fuel burning and other human activities has already hit the planet's food supply, water resources, and oceans. And poor people are suffering the most all over the world. But nobody's going to be untouched by all this. And I had the opportunity to talk to Dr. Michael Mann, a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University and director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center, yesterday. And we're going to run that interview starting now. The final draft report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which is associated with the United Nations, their final draft report, Climate Change 2014, Impacts, Adaptation, and Vulnerability, was accepted by the IPCC on March 29th, 2014, and it consists of the full scientific and technical assessment undertaken by Working Group 2. And part of this that was just intense is the part that dealt with what is going on, what's the impact of global warming, of climate change in the world now. And it's really, it's a very chilling thing for anybody who has any concern about the future of humanity, the future of the planet. You need to read this, but you also need to be aware of the fact that this is something for great, great, great concern. Joining us to talk about this now is Dr. Michael Mann. Dr. Mann is a distinguished professor of meteorology at Penn State University. He's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And his research involves the use of theoretical models and observational data to better understand Earth's climate system. Dr. Mann was a lead author on the Observed Climate Variability and Change chapter of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change Third Scientific Assessment Report in 2001, and was organizing committee chair for the National Academy of Sciences Frontiers of Science in 2003. Dr. Mann is the author of more than 160 peer-reviewed and edited publications and has published two books, including Dire Predictions, Understanding Global Warming, and The Hockey Stick in the Climate Wars, Dispatches from the Front Lines. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Michael. It's good to be with you.
The last report from the IPCC came out 7 years ago. Now there's a new one. What's changed since then? Where are things at now?
Well, it's really striking when you read this latest impacts report. And so there are three different parts of the IPCC report: the basic scientific evidence that came out just this last fall. This latest report is on the impacts of climate change, adaptation, vulnerability. And then next month, they will be reporting on the final installment, and that's on mitigation solutions, what we can do to mitigate the problem of climate change. So this latest impacts report was striking in really just how stark nature of the terms in which it is laid out. You know, this is a very conservative report by its nature, because this is a consensus of literally hundreds of leading scientists around the world. And so the report reflects almost a lowest common denominator of what all of the scientists can agree upon. In that sense, it's remarkable that the report states the threat in as stark terms as it does. Basically, what this latest report makes clear, if there were any question, is that climate change is not just some abstract, far-off existential threat. It's not just something that is going to impact polar bears in the Arctic decades from now. It's something that is impacting us here and now negatively. And in a sense, we are the polar bear. We are seeing the negative impacts of climate change, whether you are talking about issues of food and fresh water availability, whether you're talking about land, availability of land, whether you're talking about human health, whether you're talking about the health of our economy, whether you're talking about issues of conflict and national security, which, after all, are a consequence of competition for available resources. And what the report makes very clear is that if we continue on the road that we're on right now with ongoing fossil fuel burning, we will see diminished food, water, and land, and greater competition for diminishing resources among a growing global population. And that's a perfect prescription for issues of conflict, for basically a national security calamity. So the IPCC makes quite clear in this latest report that climate change is a big problem. It's not just that we know that we're warming the planet, that it's caused by human activity, fossil fuel burning and other activities raising greenhouse gas concentrations. There is now an established consensus among the world's scientists that this is a threat to us now, here and now.
Yeah, that actually came across very, very clear. And I think it's something that, one, is consistently, over the years, it's been consistently sort of like, well, yeah, you know, they're warning us now, but really, what's the rush? And we can actually do something about this. I wanted to ask you about this because it's been bugging the hell out of me, all right? The idea that when we're talking about climate change, they're talking about the temperature rising, for instance, the temperature change from 2 to 8 degrees Celsius is the span. Is that happening now? Is that what's happening? And what does it mean if it does?
Yeah, so we've already warmed up. We've warmed the planet just under 1 degree Celsius, about 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit so far. It turns out we are already committed to at least another 0.5 degree Celsius, almost another degree Fahrenheit. And that's just because of the greenhouse gases we've already emitted into the atmosphere. They will continue to warm the planet for decades. Even if we were to stop fossil fuel burning cold turkey right now, we would still see the planet warm for decades into the future, just because of the inertia of the climate system. As the oceans continue to absorb some of the heat that we have already put into the atmosphere from increased greenhouse gases. So we're already committed probably to, you know, the better part of 2 degrees Celsius, a degree and a half Celsius at a minimum. And what the science tells us is that if we continue business as usual, fossil fuel burning, for another decade or so, we will almost certainly commit to more than 2 degrees Celsius warming, more than 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit warming. And that's an important number because that's actually the threshold that many organizations and scientists who look at the impacts of climate change will tell you that 2 degrees Celsius threshold is where we really start to see some of the most damaging and potentially irreversible impacts of climate change. Again, whether we're talking about food, water, land, health, across the board, the health of ecosystems, every aspect of our lives, we will see increasingly negative impacts. And so there's an urgency to this problem, unlike anything we've seen before. If we don't act now, we likely commit to at least 2 degrees Celsius. If we continue with business as usual, if we just continue to burn fossil fuels without any effort to regulate carbon emissions, to lower our carbon footprints, then what the report tells us is that we could see, you know, as much as 4, 5 degrees Celsius, you know, 7, 8, 9 degrees Fahrenheit warming of the globe by the end of the century. And as James Hansen, my colleague James Hansen, the former director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, once put it, if we warm the planet that much, it'll be a different planet. It won't be the planet that we grew up on. We will be leaving, you know, a fundamentally degraded planet behind for our children and grandchildren.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Michael, one of the things that you keep pointing to is the fact that this is actually on the map now. It's actually concretely happening now in terms of climate change. And I wanted to talk about that and in relation to that, both what's happening in relation to food, for instance, in the vast majority of the world, which is a constant question. You know, you could see that the famines that exist in all parts of Africa and other places. If you've ever traveled at all through the third world, you have some understanding of, you know, how desperate people are for the barest minimum diet, you know. And you guys have been saying that this is going to have a terrible impact on crop yield, on food. Let's explain that.
Yeah, and so that's one of the tragedies here, that in fact the worst impacts and the impacts that are going to come soonest are going to be felt in the developing world, precisely those areas in the tropics where you have nations who are currently struggling to meet their, you know, their needs when it comes to fresh water and food. That's actually where climate change initially is going to hit hardest. And some of that is based on really fundamental science. If you warm temperatures even a little bit in the tropics, we know that you see very large decreases, very substantial decreases in the productivity of basic cereal crops. And that's simply because those crops are already growing sort of at the limit of temperature, the warmest temperatures they can grow at. And if you warm even a little bit, you see sharp drop-offs in agricultural yields. And so ironically and tragically, those nations that are least able right now to meet their food needs, we will see the largest decreases. Now, we used to think, and as recent as the last IPCC report, if you read the chapter on agriculture in the impacts part of the last IPCC report, there was language that suggested that we could actually see increases in agricultural yields in some extratropical regions, like, you know, the United States, North America, Europe, other areas at higher latitudes, the idea being that, you know, you get longer growing seasons in a warmer planet. You know, winter is shorter, the growing season is longer, and all other, you know, all else being equal, that would seem to imply increased agricultural yields. But something we've seen over the past few summers in particular is that any theoretical increase in yield that might result from longer growing seasons appears to be getting completely wiped out by increasingly extreme weather events, more widespread and pronounced drought over large parts of the U.S., like we've seen in recent summers in Texas and Oklahoma. In summer 2011, Texas, their agriculture was devastated. They lost 25% of their livestock because of the record 2011 drought. Two summers ago, we saw record drought and heat over a large part of our breadbasket, and agricultural yields were decimated. And so we now think that even extratropical regions where we thought maybe we could see an increase in agricultural yields, even here we will see decreases. And that's why this latest report comes to a much starker conclusion when it comes to food, our ability to meet our food needs. And, you know, again, what we're talking about is a growing global population in the face of diminishing food and fresh water. And that's, you know, a calamity in the making.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. Now, there's a point here, Michael, that gets repeated in the report, and it's kind of, I think it's important for people to understand what's meant by this, and it keeps talking about adaptation and adapting
right
in relation to this. Can you explain what's going on there, and then I have a follow-up question after that.
Sure thing. So our presidential science advisor, John Holdren, who's a leading scientist and has been a very effective spokesperson for this issue in the current administration, I think he once framed the problem best when he said that how we deal with climate change is going to be a combination of three things. It'll be some combination of adaptation, of mitigation, and of suffering. And it's up to us to decide what is an acceptable combination. Now, we are already seeing the suffering. There's a certain amount of climate change that's already locked in. It's already happened, and there's more that's in the pipeline. And what that means is that there's already some suffering, and there will be more suffering in the future. It means that we already have to begin adapting, whether we're talking about building up our coastal defenses against sea level rise and increasingly devastating hurricanes, whether we're talking about adapting agricultural practices in the face of warming temperatures, worse drought. On down the list, there are a whole bunch of things that we need to start doing to build the adaptive capacity to deal with some of what's already in the pipeline and is coming. But the fact is that if you look at sort of those business as usual projections, if we continue on the course that we're on, by the end of the century, we are talking about changes in climate that are so unprecedented that there's no amount of adaptation that will basically, you know, maintain any degree of resilience in the face of you know, the impacts on food and water and health and our economy. So the bottom line is, if you look at the projected impacts, this latest report, one comes to the conclusion that adaptation is not going to be adequate. We need to do a certain amount of adaptation no matter what, because there's a certain amount of climate change that's already locked in. But the fact is, there's a whole lot of other climate change that we can still prevent, and we need to engage in those actions necessary to prevent that. And that means reducing our carbon emissions. That means putting, you know, a price on the emission of carbon so that the marketplace will internalize the very real damages that climate change is already doing across the board.
I was going to ask you about, is there a point, is there a tipping point where adapting is just clearly impossible? And I think you spoke to that. You know, one of the things that struck me is there seems to be a dynamic that gets set in motion as well, which would both severely limit effective responses, like in terms of being, you know, saying that an effective response will be adapting, but also adds a whole new dimension. And I was reading somewhere about the melting Arctic that uncovers organic material that was there, you know, frozen over like before civilization began, that suddenly is laid bare and begins to rot and releases all kinds of greenhouse gases and just compounds things a tremendous amount. That seems to be something that people don't often talk about what gets unleashed in sense of a dynamic that actually gets unleashed to take over.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's, you know, we sometimes call these positive feedbacks, although that can be a misleading term to sort of a lay audience that isn't familiar with the sort of the lexicon of the science. It almost sounds good, positive feedback. You know, you get positive feedback from your boss for doing a good job. It's not a good thing. What it means, it's a vicious cycle. It means it's an aggravating response. And one of the feedbacks that we worry about are, you know, these so-called carbon cycle feedbacks. And what that means in this case is if, you know, as you allude to, if you warm the soils, if you melt the permafrost in the Arctic, well, it turns out that there's a whole lot of methane that's currently locked up in that permafrost. There's also a lot of methane that is locked up in a sort of a crystalline form, a solid form in the continental shelves. And as we warm the planet, as we warm the upper oceans, and as we warm the permafrost, there's the potential to destabilize all of that methane that's currently locked up. Now, methane, it turns out, is an even more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So if that kicks in, if we start to see those methane feedbacks kick in, then it means that suddenly we get even more warming. And that's not currently really taken into account because it's too uncertain. We don't know how to include it in the models because we don't know exactly how much of that methane is potentially unstable and could be released with even a modest amount of additional warming. So it's a great example of, you know, how uncertainty, despite, you know, what you might hear from the critics, you know, you hear people say, well, there's uncertainty in the science, so why should we take these precautions that could damage the economy? Well, actually, inaction is likely to damage the economy a whole lot more. But the fact is that uncertainty doesn't weigh in our favor. In many respects, the uncertainties are such that the problem could end up being a whole lot worse than we currently project. And here's one good example of that, Arctic sea ice. Right now, we are seeing a precipitous decline in the amount of ice that's left in the Arctic at the end of the summer, to the point where if we follow the current trend, within a couple decades, we will have ice-free conditions in the Arctic by the end of the summer. The models say that we shouldn't be there for, you know, for decades, for 50 years or so. So we are already several decades ahead of schedule in terms of how fast that sea ice is diminishing. And with that decreased sea ice means a fundamental change in the Arctic ecosystems. It means a threat to the animals that rely on that environment, which of course includes the polar bear and walruses. What it means is that we are losing an entire ecosystem. We are losing a unique ecosystem, the Arctic ecosystem, that will not be replaced. And, you know, what's the value of the Arctic ecosystem? What's the value of the Gulf of Mexico? These are the questions we should be asking as we continue to engage in very dangerous drilling of fossil fuel sources and the continued worsening of the climate change problem that's resulting from that.
All right, Dr. Michael Mann, this is unfortunately we've run out of time, but I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Sure, you too. All right, so we'll talk to you again sometime soon as this develops, all right? So stay in touch.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Dr. Michael Mann, Distinguished Professor of Meteorology at Penn State University, and he's also the director of the Penn State Earth System Science Center. And as we go out, I really want to recommend that people go to revcom.us and check out the special issue of Revolution Newspaper on the environment. It's called State of Emergency, The Plunder of Our Planet, The Environmental Catastrophe, and The Real Revolutionary Solution. Check this out. There's nothing else like that. And again, that's revcom.us. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
How sweet it is to be loved by you. Yes, baby. Ooh, how sweet it is to be loved by you. Ooh, baby. I needed the shelter of someone's arms. And there you were. I needed someone to understand my ups and downs. And there you were. With sweet love and devotion, deeply touching my emotions. I wanna stop and thank you, baby. I wanna stop and thank you.
All right, welcome back. All right, I should have a phone-in contest. Who is that? All right, everybody knows that, all right? No, they should know it. And if you don't know it, then you're being introduced to it. It's How Sweet It Is to Be Loved by You. And it's Marvin Gaye, all right? And I just felt that that was like a really great way to introduce this next segment. Joining us now is the director, John Henry Davis, and two of the actors from the play, Dr. Anonymous. The two actors are Barry Pearl, who plays a character named Edward.
And it is actually Edward. It's written that way. It isn't
Bergman.
Exactly. Yeah. Bergman. I'm not very creative. I'm not spontaneous at all.
No, I'm playing off you. You're wonderfully spontaneous, right? Else I couldn't be.
Okay. And Matt Crabtree, who plays, interestingly enough, Matthew. Okay.
I know. It's Matthew Goldstein. It was my very first manager's name.
How do you keep all this separate, man?
I don't. It is me, actually.
This is going to be an interesting discussion. The play is Dr. Anonymous. First thing I'm going to do is I'm going to ask the director to give us a synopsis of the play. Let people know what the play is about.
Well, the play is about conversion therapy of the 70s, when psychiatrists are trying to turn gay people into straight people. And the central character is Matthew Crabtree, who has an analytic session with Edward. And through the play, we see he struggles. He knows he's gay, but he struggles with the issue. And finally, he comes to a conclusion at the end of the play, which is very striking in a meeting. And it's based on the story of John Fryer, who actually came out in a meeting at the American Psychiatric Association. And that's how they changed the diagnosis so that after that, homosexuality was not a disease. So this was a very important part of American history. And that's what the play talks about.
I'm out of here. Good.
I think you got confused because you played Marvin Gaye before the gay play.
Right. As opposed to George Strait.
Yeah. It's in the play's in the middle of West Hollywood, and it's a great location.
Yeah.
You were trying to calm down the whole room, right?
That's the director in him.
There you go. All right. Well, let's talk about this a little bit, because, you know, one of the things that really struck me was the Fryer character, you know, and in terms of not that he's a character in it necessarily, but the fact that he was for real.
Yes.
That the whole situation was actually, or a big part of it was for real in one level or another. And I wanted to talk about this a little bit, because one of the things I think I mentioned to each of you before, or if not to everybody else who was in the cast, that the humanity of the people was what really was seemed to be fought for and pushed, you know, in a big way, and really and achieved in a certain sense, which is something that's very, very difficult, I think, to do often, especially when you're in a situation where so much is concentrated. Like conversion therapy, it wasn't just a mistaken idea. It was outright torture, you know,
that's right.
And it was dehumanizing
that's right.
gay people, you know. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to talk with like Barry, you played a conversion therapy psychiatrist.
Right.
What did you think about that?
Well, it doesn't really matter what I think about it, and I'm not being flip, because my thoughts and feelings are exceedingly antithetical to Dr. Bergman, and I just have to give up those personal considerations and embrace this particular character whose passion it is to help. To help, that he's coming from his heart in that way, to make gay guys who are gay men and women who are tortured souls, he believes, to be straight and hence live a normal, quote unquote, normal life and be a productive member of society, as he says. So if I embrace that passion and that positive objective, then I'm fine. I'm on the path. So I think that there is a great deal of humanity which runs through his core, because he's exceedingly well-intentioned.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting, too, though, because when you look at conversion therapy and how it progressed over the last, whatever, 40 years or whatever, you know, this whole, it became and very much was rooted in a lot of Christian fundamentalism,
sure.
A lot of these cats that were just like, you know, you are evil. I mean, I was reading accounts of it that where people were tortured in various forms, you know, electric shocks applied. Mm-hmm. I think that's even, isn't that even spoken
it's
to?
It's spoken or, about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I believe mm-hmm. in the video clips, I don't think is. Oh, no.
It's in the scene five.
Jake talks about it.
Yeah,
yes, that's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Right. Yeah, and it's very heavy, because, you know, while your character is proceeding from that, it's often, even when people proceed from that, they oftentimes can contribute to the buildup and the strengthening of an overall, what I was talking with Sansara Taylor about in terms of abortion, a new normalcy where the most horrendous things become acceptable.
Right.
Yes.
Matt, growing out of fear.
Yeah. All right. Real quick, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show. And we're talking today about the play Dr. Anonymous. It's all about gay conversion therapy. And we're talking with the director of the play, John Henry Davis, and actors Matt Crabtree and Barry Pearl.
Yes.
Matt, let's talk about your character.
Yes.
Because I thought you concentrated in a way that was really, really good the social impact and the personal impact mm-hmm. of a very dangerous approach in psychiatry and in society in general, as we're talking about this point about conversion, that you're gay because you choose to it. It's something you just like really like, but it's not as, and it's something that is offensive to the rest of society, and it's really going to screw you up as well. Let's talk about that, because you go through, you walk through that, and it's a very painful character, you know, in terms of, not painful to the audience, but you can see you going through a tremendous amount of pain in your character as he's dealing with this.
Yes, it's fascinating too, because, you know, even nowadays you still have people that are hiding the fact that who they are for various reasons, because you can still get fired in many states for being homosexual, and especially in the late 1960s, early 70s, from the research I did, because I wasn't around then.
And who was, Matt? Oh, wait a minute, I was.
I think I'm outnumbered here today.
Yes.
But it was
look
very,
around the room, brother.
Yeah. Crap. Hi. Is this thing on?
Unfortunately.
This thing on? No, it was very difficult, the show itself, because Matthew goes through everything from, you know, has so much self-hatred in him at the beginning, and then realizing this conversion therapy is not working. And that there's something wrong with the system and something wrong with the world at that particular time. So he tries to do everything he can to get away from that and try to help people in his own way. And then sometimes that doesn't really always work. And then he gets thrown back into this way of, you know, if one way is not working, we've got to make it work another way. So that's why he goes back into therapy the second time with Edward.
He's torn between his gay lover and the figure of Edward, who becomes like a father figure to him. And I want to say about Matt's performance.
And this is John, the director, okay? Just so people know,
John Henry
Davis.
Yeah. John Henry speaking. I just want to say that when you talk about the pain of the character, Matt actually goes through that pain on stage every night. He's not the kind of actor that you know, just pretends to be in pain. I can see the pain, and that's, I think, what's so beautiful about the play, is that we really feel what's going on in the play, and especially through these great performances.
Let's give people a taste of it, all right? You guys are prepared to do something, so...
We'll make it up. We'll rewrite it. It'll be the essence of it.
Great.
Okay.
Hello, Dr. Glass. Hello. Yes.
Right.
All right. So why don't you tell people what the scene is, and then just we'll go through it.
Sure.
Mr. Director.
Yes, actually,
okay.
Yes, please.
This is our director, John Henry Davis.
So this is, by the way, the play is by Guy Glass.
I was going to ask you.
Who was a former, is a psychiatrist, actually, and who wrote this play based on some of his own experiences. This is the first scene where they encounter each other. It's actually the interview that would get him into the Institute. And so, which is an institute where they teach conversion therapy. So he's a young medical student. That's who Dr. Goldstein is at this point. And they're being interviewed. He's being interviewed by Edward.
So you have a girlfriend?
Girlfriend?
Yeah, girlfriend.
There's a girl I've seen a few times.
Well, what's her name?
Name?
Yeah, she's got one, doesn't she?
Yeah, of course. Of course she does. Her name is Ruth.
Ah! Ruth. It's like Ruth Buzzy from Laugh-In, which you were talking about before. Yeah. Mm-hmm. She must really enjoy watching TV with you.
Oh, yes.
But I bet she's not much into Mozart, though. I mean, so few women know their Marriage of Figaro from the Lucia di Lammermoor.
Lucia di Lammermoor is by Donizetti.
Oh. Unlike what you told me before, you do seem to be a dabbler of the finer things in life. You're crossing your legs.
Hmm?
Yeah, you're crossing your legs.
No, I'm not.
No, but you were.
No, you were going to tell me about a case.
Oh, yes, but you have told me so much more.
I have not told you a thing.
Oh, you told me quite a few things.
Oh, my God, I told you a thing?
Yeah, you told me that you may be anxious, which under the circumstances can be expected. You told me that you might be attempting to conceal something, which is not. And you've told me that you may not be a candidate for our institute.
If you let me in, I promise I'll never cross my legs
there
again.
There is no girlfriend. No girlfriend now, no girlfriend ever.
Of course there's a girlfriend.
And the opera.
I've never been to an opera.
Oh.
And I just made it up to impress
now,
you,
you
sir.
You eat the stuff up. Please.
I've lived a very sheltered life, not once on the main
don't line. Play dumb with me. No, you don't have the girlfriend. You see, I look into the unconscious for a living.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I think you know very well.
I thought this was a sure thing. I mean, look at those recommendations.
Yes, they're great. Yes, you never would have gotten this far.
All right. Now, it's just a taste. It's
just
really...
a little taste.
Yeah. A vorspeise, an appetizer.
What am I unleashing here?
Well, interesting, anyway, unleashing. You know, it's interesting because... because Dr. Fryer
he didn't
did
mean
in fact.
It. Oh, sorry,
no, not
Barry.
In that.
Sorry.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Didn't Dr. That. Fryer did unleash back in when he came out and he unmasked himself. Mm-hmm. It was heard round the world because it then gave license for. For people coming out to happen. I mean, it took a while, but now especially in the entertainment industry, it's not a stigma, you know. Mm-hmm. It's not like Brock Hudson trying to keep it from people. It's natural and normal to be who you are and fly that flag, folks.
Although,
I have to disagree with that. I don't think it's it's better than it used to be.
Oh, I'm saying it is.
Oh, okay.
It would not have happened had it not been for people like Fryer.
Of course.
Right.
Absolutely.
And I want to talk about that in a minute. Although first I want to remind people you're listening to The Michael Slate Show. And we are talking today with John Henry Davis, the director of the play Dr. Anonymous, and two of the actors in the play, Barry Pearl, who plays Edward, who's the shrink who does all the, who is really trying to apply conversion therapy, and Matt Crabtree, who plays... Matthew. A very powerful portrayal of Matthew, yeah. And a very powerful character. So it's both of you guys. It's very powerful. Now, John Henry, tell me this. You talked about this on two levels when you were actually, and you've worked with the playwright before, right?
Yes.
And you've and he grew up, actually, he probably grew up not far from what both where you and I grew up, Barry,
right.
In terms of, you know, different that area in general. But one of the things that you talked about was you really were approaching this from the assertion of identity to a certain extent and how people perceive you. And then you also talked about, you combine that with, at the same time, there's something that to me, when I was reading it, linked, you know, and not necessarily a really, you know, obvious link, but it gets back to what we were saying about what is the situation facing gay people today, you know, is that it was also occurring at a time when it meant devastation to a lot of people for careers, for their life, you know, in terms of to stand up and to say, I'm gay.
Yeah, I've known many people, intellectuals, brave people in their hearts who could not come out, who resisted that. And I think the play has a larger meaning, too, about taking off masks, about revealing who we really are, about being brave enough to face oneself and to reveal that to the world. I think that's a very important message. And I think Guy's really tapped into something universal here in the play. And I hope that it will encourage people to be more open about who they are.
You know, one of the things that you also mentioned in this little write-up here that I was reading, that you mentioned, and I thought this was interesting, because the role of opera in the thing, because it's not just sort of like, okay, this is a standard sort of shtick that you can say, okay, if you're a gay man, you're into opera. There actually was a role, and you talked about how even you talked about the staging of the play as being somewhat operatic in your own thinking.
Right. There's a theatricality, and Guy's way of writing really exposes a kind of operatic feeling. Edward even uses the word, oh, this behavior is operatic. And I think also there's something about opera which synthesizes the truest, most deepest feelings. I think that's what the play is trying to do. And like opera, there's comedy in it, you know, as well as the seriousness of it. So I think that opera as a genre with its sensual approach to art is definitely part of this play.
Well, let's talk about one more. I think we have time for one more question. And if I'm really quick asking it, because we can't talk about the play without talking about the backdrop in the play of Philadelphia police commissioner at the time, Frank Rizzo, and the really deeply fascistic assaults he launched against gay people. And I remember those things very clearly. I remember the raids on the clubs. I remember the kind of, and it was, you know, he went after black people, he went after people, all kinds of people, but he was very vehement about going after gay people. And that was, and I remember seeing people lined up. I remember seeing the head wounds in the Philadelphia Bulletin, the Evening Bulletin. I remember seeing these pictures and whatnot. And knowing that I was going to school out, you know, a few miles outside of the city at the time, but this was a major, major part of that whole scene. So let's talk about that a little for a while.
Well, he did it to gain political support. He was trying to get a certain constituency to vote for him because he wanted to be mayor. You know, he was police commissioner, and this was a tactic.
But don't you think that there's also some of this thing that we're talking about in terms of the dehumanization? I mean, look, to Rizzo, black people were not human, gay people were not human, and damn it, they were going to be if he could have rounded them up and put them in camps, that's what would have happened.
Right.
So how did you guys look at this, at that whole backdrop? Because that's sort of, that is really literally the backdrop in a lot of ways, with the scenes of the assaults on gay people and the assertion of people's, you know, right to the declaration of, I'm human, damn it, and you'll treat me as a human.
Well, it shows too, in the show itself, also Matthew's journey because he sees this stuff going on. He knows what's happening in the real world now, and he knows that he can't really truly be himself until he falls in love, and then he really can't seem to hide that anymore. So having the backdrop of Rizzo, knowing the violence that was out there at the time, and knowing you know, your job insecurity because of that, you really helped fuel the show even more, I thought.
Mm-hmm. And just one more time for people to know, because we are running out of our time. The play is Dr. Anonymous. It's a really great play. So, guys, thank you very much for joining
us. Thank you.
Find us online.
Pleasure. Yes, online as well.
Okay, there you go.
BarryPearl.com.
Well, that's a whole other story.
I think okay. You can do that.
All right.
That's
all
Dr. Not So Anonymous.
Wow. Nice going, Matt.
Thank you.
Anyway, all right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Barry Pearl, Matt Crabtree, and John Henry Davis, and they're from the play Dr. Anonymous. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank all of my guests today, the director and crew from Dr. Anonymous, who we've just been speaking with, as well as Sansara Taylor and Dr. Michael Mann. I also want to thank my assistant producer today, Henry Carson, and my production assistant, Jeff Pryor. I also want to thank my engineer, Federico Garcia. Now, there's something I want to do before we go out, because I've been thinking about this a lot, and it's related to the segment we did with Dr. Mann. All right, and I just think it's really important for people to get a sense of what exactly is going on here. What are the interests that are in play here? And what are the interests? Who are these people that are actually tearing up the entire planet? Calling into question the possibility of human survival, okay? So let's listen to this. This is from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from a filmed talk called Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, What It's All About. This system and those who rule over it are not capable of carrying out economic development to meet the needs of the people now while balancing that with the needs of future generations and requirements of safeguarding the environment. They care nothing for the rich diversity of the earth and its species, for the treasures this contains, except when and where they can turn this into profit for themselves. These people are not fit to be the caretakers of the earth. All right, and again, that's from Bob Avakian, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's from the film talk Revolution, Why It's Necessary, Why It's Possible, and What It's All About. And if you want to hear the entire talk, you can do so at revolutiontalk.net. Now, I also want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me on Facebook and Twitter, please do so. Now, we're going to go out with a song that I thought was very appropriate for today's show, every aspect of today's show. And it's from the Tom Robinson Band. And it's a piece called Power in the Darkness. Check this out. Talk to you again next week.
For brothers to love.